Hi, this is Newt. 2020 is going to be one of the most extraordinary election years of our lifetime. I want to invite you to join my inner circle as we discuss each twist and turn in the presidential race in my members-only Inner Circle Club. You'll receive special flash briefings, online events, and members-only audio reports from me and my team. Here is a special offer for my podcast listeners. Join my inner circle today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast. And if you sign up for a 1 or 2 year membership, you'll get 10% off your membership price and a VIP fast pass to my live events. Join my inner circle today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast. Use the code podcast at checkout. Sign up today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast and use the code podcast. Hurry, this offer expires February 14th. In the last episode of Newt's World, we explored what 5G technology is and the promising future of connectivity and improvements it may bring to all of our lives. On this episode, we're looking more closely at some of the concerns around 5G technology. I did a Facebook Live interview about 5G 2 weeks ago, and we heard from many of you who are concerned about the health effects 5G may pose. Some of you also expressed concern about the collection of big data and privacy. This episode will address some of those questions and cover the global race to develop and deploy 5G and the national security implications that loom over us if the United States, both the government and the private sector, do not act quickly with clear public policy direction and significant investment. We'll also look at the main Chinese companies who are investing billions in 5G, Huawei, and ZTE. I'm pleased to welcome as my guest, Brigadier General Robert Spalding, former Senior Director for Strategic Planning at the National Security Council. General Spalding, it is really an honor to have you on Newt's World today for this conversation. We had a lot of people that were more worried about personal security than national security, and specifically about health concerns. We had a lot of different people who wrote us and asked, what are the potential health risks from 5G? Some of them being concerned about equipment being set up as a mesh network over the cities, some of them about the whole nature of the new small cell towers. When you look at all this, have you run across anything which leads you to be concerned on a health side from the implementation of 5G?
Yeah, so the health concerns are primarily related to the high band, which is the millimeter wave band, which if you look at the entire 5G implementation, there's three bands. There's a low band, a mid band, and a high band. The low band and mid band are currently coincident with other cellular technologies like 4G. The only issue really is with high band, and really it's an unknown issue at this point. There's some that speculate that it could cause some heating of the skin surface and then be potentially carcinogenic, but I don't think the testing has definitively proved out one way or the other. I will say that the way that they're implementing 5G with beamforming will tend to not expose the body to direct impact of the signal, because the idea is to keep line of sight between the tower and the device itself. So rather than other cellular equipment, which currently broadcasts in a wide area, this would be more focused like a pencil beam. So I think what you'll see is the phones will be designed so that there's shielding of the human body if it's needed, but primarily since millimeter wave won't go through the human body, they're designing the equipment to get around exposing the human body to the signal. The other thing to note is that this is a technology that's used to scan your body when you go through the airport. So it's not like these people aren't being essentially exposed to this type of frequencies. They're being exposed when they fly somewhere. So I'm sure that there was studies done before DHS implemented that technology. And I think I remember back then there was also this fear that, you know, it could potentially cause cancer. But the truth is that the requisite federal agency has to ensure that it meets the defined health problems that actually come from research. And I haven't seen any research that actually supports that.
The other place where people worry about security is the whole question about big data and privacy. We had some very interesting conversations about the notion that you're going to be on the edge of having the kind of big data that can anticipate what you want because it knows you so well that it'll sort of say, gee, you know, would you like to pick up some carrots this afternoon while you're at the store? And some people feel they're not sure they want some external system knowing that much about them. How do you react to the whole question about big data and privacy concerns?
Well, it's fine when Amazon is trying to sell you things that you need, but it's not fine when a totalitarian regime is using it to analyze who they should target and then taking the people that you know and that listen to you as an influential person in their lives and then using advanced data analysis, artificial intelligence in this area. The Russians have shown the ability to do this. The Chinese have as well. And then use your network to begin to influence the people that you know in a way that you never intended. And that's a real challenge because over time, what you'll see is a use of these social media networks to create artifacts in our society that are really designed to break down our society and get people to no longer believe in the government or in how the society itself should operate.
You have to worry about this kind of use of data and the whole notion that I may not have recommended anything, but you just got a message that suggested that I recommended it. And it reads exactly as though it came from me.
Right. Since they trust you, they would tend to believe, oh, okay, well, if Newt says this is a good idea, maybe I should also think this way. And in that way, and then we saw this during, again, the 2016 elections, we were beginning to put groups together that would normally never have any affiliation, but because they'd been hijacked from their original leaders, that they moved into areas that they actually didn't believe in, and the leader didn't believe. If you take a step back and you look at it from a societal perspective, in a way, with the use of social media, you can completely bypass the use of weapons and go directly to the society and create the same kind of effects that we were able to create with weapons.
When we come back, we'll discuss the looming Chinese threat if they're able to roll out 5G worldwide first. Let me ask just a straightforward question that I've been very sobered by. And I have to say, I think you were the first person when you were still at the National Security Council. I remember being introduced to you in a briefing you gave on just how formidable the Chinese threat would be. And you were sort of a voice in the wilderness at that point. I'm now working on a book about China. And the more closely I look at this, the more impressed I am with the scale of their effort and the kind of methodical, patient way they're approaching it. Can you talk with us, as you began to look at Huawei and the whole rise of 5G in China, how did you find it, and how did you come to grips with the scale of what we're facing?
Well, I remember distinctly in the fall of 2013, when I was a military fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, a lunch I had with a man that had about $1 billion of assets invested in China. And he'd gone through the financial crisis and come out the other side. He realized, especially with the elevation of President Xi, that the country was going in a completely different direction. So he sold all his assets and returned them to the investors. And we had a discussion about where China was headed at that time. And I believed that their economy was going to stagnate. And he said it was going to continue to grow and they were going to eventually outstrip the United States. And over the course of the following year, he provided information and data, and we had a series of dialogues that actually ended up changing my mind. And by this time, I was at the Joint Staff in the Pentagon. And the epiphany for me was a briefing that he shared with me that had been produced by a very large auditing firm in the United States. And it essentially showed vignette after vignette of how the Chinese had gone after companies and essentially put them under pressure to acquire some piece of technology. And it was sophisticated. It was almost a precision airstrike in terms of how they went about it, combining cyber and financial knowledge to put these companies under duress in order to get technology. And it was at that point that I realized that I didn't understand how the world worked from a financial and economic perspective. And the scope and scale of this was so large and primarily hidden because most companies won't report if they've been hit because it either affects their valuation or potentially legal ramifications for the company. So this was a stealth attack that was going on, quite frankly, across the country. And at that point is when I really started to focus on understanding what China had created, how they had done it, and what were the implications for the United States. And so by the time you saw me at the White House, I was 5 years into that study, and I had the clear view of nearly everything that they were doing. But even today, I learn things every single day that really demonstrate how incredibly prescient the thinking was by the Chinese leadership and how much of a precision strategic campaign they've waged. This is a problem that features in China with a lot of policy. Because the Chinese Communist Party is so opaque in terms of how it does things, there are orders issued, and Huawei has a demonstrated close relationship with the military since going back to, I have an article that somebody sent me from 2000 talking about its close relationship with the People's Liberation Army. So there are discussions that happen that aren't reported where essentially the government indicates in which way they would like Huawei to go. And so I have not seen anything that was public, but what I have seen is kind of behind the scenes, they were told to focus on this as early as 2007 as a strategy for the country. Everybody understands that these wireless evolutions come every 10 years. So they understood that the next one that comes, they want to dominate it. And so whether it was called 5G or just the next generation of wireless, we want to dominate. That's what they were making the decision about. And everybody, even before 5G is thought of, there's thoughts about what would come beyond that. And so before it's called 6G or whatever we're going to call it, people are thinking about what that means. And I think that's a better way of thinking about it. We understand that this technology is going to continue to evolve. It's not going to stop at any one number or evolution.
We were very fortunate to be guests of Samsung when they took Calista and me to their new smart factory, which is a very heavily automated, very dust-free, remarkable system. They have an ability there to create 5G capability better than anybody else outside of China. They are very determined to create the ability for their entire society to be using 5G, whether it's in healthcare or in smart cities or in sports or in entertainment. I found it kind of amazing to see the experiments they were running, the projects they had, for example, with a drone, which was giving you basically virtual reality through 5G while flying over a sporting field. So I think that Samsung really has made an investment in developing a different and a more powerful future. And I think their rollout is going to be a major event in the implementation of 5G. So along that line, the other great danger is that the three primary equipment manufacturers outside China are, in fact, I think, investing between them about a third as much money in research and development as Huawei is. Unless there's some pretty dramatic change, the gap is likely to get bigger in the next 5 or 10 years in terms of not just price, but also capability. Is that also your understanding, General Spaulding?
It is. And if you think about it from a national security perspective, imagine if we took the $800 billion a year that we're spending in defense and a portion that was allocated to building these really advanced networks. Now, if you look at China, they've aligned a lot of their national strategic initiatives around the deployment of 5G. There's the Belt and Road Initiative, which is linking all the nations of Eurasia and Africa and Latin America and some in Asia now, both in the maritime and on the landward side, but also with a digital Belt and Road. So you have that enormous strategic plan, almost like the Marshall Plan. You have the 2013 plan that you mentioned, the five-year plan. You also have China Manufacturing 2025. And you also have the science and technology, long-term science and technology plan, the Thousand Talents Plan. All of these initiatives essentially combine to amplify both with money, resources, but also complementary technologies and capabilities that make what China is offering all the more powerful. It's not just a company strategy. It is a national strategy.
So when you look down the road, if we don't find a way to respond effectively, from your background, having been an analyst on the National Security Council, what's the worst case scenario if the Chinese continue deploying 5G worldwide and we turn out to be incapable of responding?
Well, I think you're going to continue to see what we saw and what led to the creation of the Trump administration's national security strategy, which is we had essentially lost control of geopolitics. In other words, the world had been drifting away from supporting and promoting democratic principles and U.S. national interests. And so what you're going to find is a world that increasingly acts according to Chinese dictates and not U.S. dictates, which is incredibly frightening because of their illiberal norms, the readiness to suppress speech, to suppress freedom of religion, to the readiness to oppress.
Well, along that line, I want to bring up a specific case I think you're aware of that was reported in an article entitled Marriott Employee Roy Jones Hit Like Then China Got Mad. The subtitle was The Severity of the Penalty, Termination Not Reprimand, Highlights the Unforgiving Consequence for Companies That Offend China. It's a fascinating story by Wayne Ma. And here's what he says, that Roy Jones was running social media accounts for Marriott International at $14 an hour. And the company had listed Tibet separately from the country of China. And the group applauded Marriott for listing Tibet separately. And Jones said he liked that post. So he just put a like up. Marriott then said, oh, it was a mistake listing Tibet separately, because, of course, the Chinese government feels very deeply about this. And in fact, they feel so deeply that Marriott actually fired him on January 14th for having said that he liked the post about China and Tibet being separate places. And I thought it was fascinating that the pressure apparently had been brought to bear by the Chinese government, and that, in fact, this is not a unique thing. Give you a couple more quick examples. Zhao Zhang, who's a Chinese internet expert at the University of California at Berkeley, said, quote, not only can't you speak freely inside of China, but you can't even speak freely outside of China, and that's really bad, close quote. And I think that it's interesting that you have this increasing aggressiveness by the Chinese who are willing to go after people all over the world, not just in China itself. To what extent, as they get more and more social control they have through 5G, more and more information, to what extent do you think we're going to be facing a very assertive China trying to push things that we would never have dreamed possible in the past?
Yeah, I think I look at that as a very clumsy kind of, 4G, if you want to use that term, or even 20th century, with technology version of what they're going to be able to do. As time goes forward, they're going to create the same kind of effect. In other words, they're going to create censorship, but you're not even going to know you're being censored. It's going to be something that you voluntarily do because you've been incentivized to do so in a way that is almost imperceptible to you, much like you a very advanced marketing campaign with technology that's going on now. So I think that just is indicative in a very visible way of what they want in terms of intent. Now they're putting in the pieces so they can do that technologically in a way that is really imperceptible.
The thing that's sobering, and I know you've seen this because we've been together looking at it, but Rivada Networks has put together a map of Huawei around the world. And I think there are over 60 countries now that have either licensing agreements or partnerships with Huawei for the rollout of 5G. And there are very few countries which are rejecting the Huawei technology, including many of our allies, Great Britain, Germany, and others. So it strikes me that at the moment, at least, we are really on defense, and they are really spreading with remarkable speed around the world. I mean, how would you analyze that?
I think that's exactly right. And for the last 2 years, I've been both talking to the federal government and talking to industry to get somebody to do something about it. But both sides, industry says that they're going to do something about it, but in reality, they don't have the ability to do anything about it in terms of they're carrying too high a debt load, and they really have a lot of 4G investments that they still need to work off. And the government really doesn't see that it's a responsibility of the government. In a lot of ways, we're stuck in the situation where we're a prisoner of our own success in terms of we've found a model, you know, with free markets and democratic principles that worked for us prior to the evolution of this technology. And it's beginning to move away from us in a way that suggests that the Chinese and a lot of elites have told me privately that they believe that China has a better economic model, and it may be something that we should begin to think about.
The United States must act quickly in order to protect U.S. interests in a 5G world. We'll talk about the coalition and the investment that's needed when we come back. One thing has become apparent to me. The United States government needs a direction that it can send signals not only to our own government and our own private sector, but also to the rest of the world. After Sputnik, we made very clear that we were in the race to get into space. We were in it seriously, and we planned to win it. Now I think we're back in a similar situation, and both Congress and the executive branch and the private sector have to develop a series of strategies that are going to both protect our health and our privacy, but they're also going to protect our economy and our national security. It strikes me that we still have a tremendous amount of work to do. I know you have been trying to arouse interest in this for several years now. Do you feel like you're making progress, or do you think the mountain may be higher than we expected?
No, I definitely think the mountain's higher than we expected. I think there's the way that our system works, the way the private sector works. It works because the C-suite and the board of directors have a fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders. Verizon and AT&T don't write a national security strategy. They write a strategy to make the most profits for their shareholders. They are not incentivized to do things that are in the national interest in a way that the federal government is. At the same time, the federal government has basically been designed around this very hands-off approach to business and letting them, in terms of is if it's not harmful to the citizenry, to kind of pursue their interests. And so we have a fundamental flaw in our system. We have a, like you say, a Sputnik moment, but it's something that we're just not prepared as a nation to address, either from the private sector because the system doesn't work that way, or from the federal government because it's looking to the private sector to do something that the private sector is not incentivized currently to do.
5G may be the most important topic for our national security, our economy, our quality of life that we will deal with in the rest of our lifetime. 5G is so powerful and offers so many opportunities and threats that if, in fact, the Chinese dominate 5G, they will change the world we live in. They will dominate economically, they will dominate militarily, and they will dominate in sheer knowledge. So they will know who you call. They will know what's in your bank account. They will know your health records. This is not some simple, small thing. This is the central science and technology revolution of the next 50 years. If the United States does not get its act in place, if the United States does not catch up, and we have to play catch up, we are now behind. And if we're not prepared to do what it takes to win, we are very likely going to be in a world dominated by the Chinese, who will then have a capacity over and over again to tell us to do the things they want, or to have our ATMs turned off, to tell us to do what they want, or to discover that our cell phones don't work very well. I think it's very hard to imagine how radically different our lives would be if we actually had a totalitarian dictatorship with that kind of intimate impact on our daily lives, on our economy, and on our national security. And so we'll come back again and again over the next year or two to 5G, reporting on how's it coming, what's working, what isn't working, what do we need to focus on. And I hope you will find that learning about 5G helps you better understand the kind of things, both on the positive side, that are going to make your life better, and the kind of things which on the negative side could make your life dramatically worse. I'd like to hear more about what you think about 5G. Please email me with your comments at newt@newtsworld.com. We'll follow up with another 5G episode in the near future. Thank you for listening. Thank you to my guest, Brigadier General Robert Spalding. You can see the articles, videos, and documents that we relied on in researching this episode on our show page at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Westwood One. The executive producer is Debbie Myers. Our producer is Garnsey Sloan. Our editor is Robert Borowski. Our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. The music was composed by Joey Salvia. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360 and Westwood One's Tim Sabian and Robert Mathers. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what Newt's World is all about. On the next episode of Newt's World, what do we really know about the Korean Peninsula? I'll be joined by Dr. Stephen Norper for an in-depth discussion about the history of U.S. involvement in the Korean Peninsula and what we all need to know about what is happening with North and South Korea today.
I think there's tremendous potential, part of which is in the character of the Korean people and in what we've seen by way of their adaptability, their flexibility, and the rise of South Korea. As much as the international media says, what's the model for North Korea? Is it China? Is it Vietnam or elsewhere? Really, the best model is to the South.
I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.